Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Of the news. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. The Fifth Estate opened in theaters across the country this weekend, mainly to empty theaters. What's keeping moviegoers away from this drama about WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange? There's also no question, actress Melissa McCarthy, she does draw a bit more of a crowd. She's on the cover of the November issue of Elle magazine. Were editors there trying to send a message about the plus-size actress when they dressed her in an oversized trench coat? And tonight is Game 1 of the World Series, an exciting night for Redbird fans here in mid-Missouri and across the country. But due to an ongoing dispute between DirecTV and the owners of our local Fox affiliate, Columbia and Jefferson City viewers are scrambling to find a place to watch the big game. There's a lot more that we're hopefully going to get to as well, but let's start out with some tech news. Yesterday was dubbed by some in the business as Tablet Tuesday, with a number of new releases hitting the streets. Mike, tell us what some of the highlights were. What came out yesterday?
Well, the most obvious and biggest news revolved around the new iPad, the iPad Air, and that's because it's lighter and thinner. But, you know, Apple has really figured out how to do this incremental change well. I mean, every little incremental change is the greatest new thing in tablets. There are some critics that suggest maybe they didn't do enough new things. For example, it doesn't have the fingerprint scanner that the new iPhone has on it, but it'll probably still sell really well when it is available for sale in a couple of weeks. The Surface 2 from Microsoft is also released. Yesterday, went on sale actually yesterday, and the Surface 2 didn't. They hope it will do better than the original Surface tablet, which hasn't done very well at all. Microsoft took an almost $1 billion write down because it couldn't sell them. And then Nokia has gotten into the game. Nokia's handset division, interestingly enough, has been purchased by Microsoft. That deal will close in a little bit later, but Nokia is trying to get into the tablet game with a Windows 8 tablet as well. There's lots of ways you can compare what's good and bad about them, but it's always an uphill climb for anybody going against the iPad unless you make an Android tablet. There wasn't a new Android tablet released yesterday, but there were some new data released in the past week that shows for the first time ever, globally, there are more Android tablets that are selling than iPads.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I'm noticing in my class is that I'm having more and more students with the Android tablet as opposed to the iPad. I think they like the fact that it's less expensive, it looks a little sleeker, it fits with the computers that they're using because a lot of students outside of here in journalism have PCs as opposed to Macs. So I think that having that compatibility in that regard is really, really making that a bigger statement.
How much do you think price point factors into that as well?
A little bit, because you have some devices like the Kindle Fire, which sell much lower price points than, say, the iPad. The iPad Mini was introduced to try to go after that customer base, but still, it's more expensive. And there's a feeling that in the developing world, especially in markets like China and India, that price, of course, is going to make a difference, and you have some very competitive companies like Samsung and some Chinese companies that could really take a lot of business away from Apple.
I was reading an article right before we got together for the show that talked about a $40 tablet that's being introduced in East Palo Alto for the schools there, and they're also doing the same thing in Raleigh, North Carolina, to try to get tablets into the hands of those who can't afford it, and mainly the underprivileged kids, and sort of deal with the digital inequality that we're seeing in terms of the technology right now, and a way to really enhance the educational aspects of the technology.
And when you get to the world of journalism, you have some really interesting tensions about the tablet market, because tablets are very important, especially to historic newspaper companies. But Do you want to have one standard and one operating system? It would be easier to create content for that. Or do you want to have multiple platforms so that you're not at the mercy of one player like an Apple? You could have both if you had the HTML5 standard, a way for delivering content to multiple screens and operating systems and having it look the same, but we're not quite there yet.
I think one of the other aspects of this is what the apps are going to be like, what's the other hardware that's going to be involved, I think, is the Surface, with the Surface you can actually use UBS ports and that sort of thing, which Apple doesn't have. What's happening with Wi-Fi in terms of, are you able to have that kind of access? Are you going to be able to connect it to, say, your data plan and that sort of thing? And is that going to increase the cost? So when you start talking about price points, it's not just the product itself, is everything that goes along with it.
The ancillary things as well. Well, about 10 days ago, there was a screening of the film The Fifth Estate at Ragtag. That film opened nationwide this past weekend. The drama, based on real events, tells the story of Julian Assange and his founding of WikiLeaks and the relationship that organization also had with German computer programmer Daniel Berg. It wasn't too popular with American moviegoers, only bringing in $1.7 million this weekend. That makes it the worst open for a widespread theatrical release in 2013. So if you're Julian Assange, though, you've got to be thrilled that nobody went to go see this movie.
I guess. He did campaign for almost a year against the movie and for a documentary that's about WikiLeaks as well. But there's lots of reasons why the movie might not have done well. It was up against several awards-caliber films that were released this past weekend. Plus, you've still got Gravity that's out there that's cleaning up. So there's lots of choices for moviegoers. And I'm not so sure that the typical American moviegoer wants to see a Hollywood film about somebody who's been so vilified by the U.S. government and a lot of other folks.
I think the other reason is that, you know, with the Eric Snowden and his leaking of the NSA and all of those things, I think people are sort of they're getting a little bit tired of all the sort of pseudo espionage of leaks and NSA and security and this sort of thing, and the last place they want to see it again is at the movie theater.
So it's a little too real, maybe, to be plunking down your $10 for a movie ticket on that one.
It's interesting, though, because it seems to me, from what I have not seen the movie yet, nor have I seen the documentary about Assange, but from what I've heard from other people writing and talking about it, they're not a flattering picture of Assange. I mean, in fact, both of the movie and the documentary say a lot about WikiLeaks and are generally favorable toward the things that WikiLeaks did in trying to showcase transparency and release government documents in its early days. But both the documentary and the movie also kind of paint Assange as this egotistical, sort of almost egomaniacal person who maybe has done damage to the whole notion of transparency.
So now that you bring that up, this documentary, that's the movie that critics out there are saying we should be going to see. It's called We Steal Secrets. It's been produced by Alex Gibney, and he appeared on Fox's Media Buzz this past Sunday talking about his attempt to get Julian Assange to cooperate and work with him on that.
You approached Julian Assange for cooperation with your documentary, and what happened?
He said no. He said no over a great period of time. I had a rather spectacular six-hour nonstop meeting with him where he asked for a lot of money. I said I wouldn't give it to him. And then, more interesting than that, he asked if I would spy on all the other interview subjects for him. For a guy interested in source protection, that struck me as rather odd.
You said no pretty quickly,
I
imagine.
No, yes.
So when I saw that last Sunday, I was kind of taken aback by it in a way. Does it surprise you guys at all that he had that was Assange's?
Well, I think it goes back to what Mike was talking about with the ego. I think one of the things that has happened over the course of this long drawn out story between various governments and going after Julian Assange is that he sort of feels as if, you know, he needs to have some vindication in whatever form he can get it. And I think this is maybe an attempt by him to possibly get that, because he went after the movie saying that, you know, it didn't portray him accurately. He didn't participate in the documentary because he couldn't control it. So he's looking for other vehicles in which to do this.
Some people think that, you know, that he sees conspiracies around every corner, that at the very least he has a persecution complex. He's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
He has been on the run for how long?
But, you know, interestingly enough, at the Online News Association conference that we were at last week in Atlanta, the screenwriter for The Fifth Estate was talking about the impact of Assange on journalists attempting to showcase the spying that our government and others are doing on each other. And his notion was basically that Assange has done great damage, that Edward Snowden, for example, followed the, quote, correct path, and you can agree or disagree with this, by giving his documents over to reporters, not simply putting them out there sort of unfiltered, that he didn't let the Russians or the Chinese have access to them. But yet the public seems to paint Snowden and the journalists working with Snowden in the with the same brush as Assange. And so Julian Assange, with his sort of ego-driven efforts at WikiLeaks, might have harmed the efforts to get transparency through the media.
Yeah, I also think that one of the stories that hasn't come out is that, especially involving Eric Snowden, is how in our zeal to sort of bring in corporations in terms of helping to keep costs down and operating national security and actually being involved in wars, we've sort of haven't done what's necessary, or the government hasn't done what's necessary to check the background of these people, and then they wind up being able to get this information and present it. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have leaks, or that I'm against leaks and that sort of thing, but it also speaks to the other side, which is the government's not in charge of our national security. In some instances, it's private corporations.
You know, you said the movie, the figures show that this movie about Assange and WikiLeaks did really poorly. I wonder what a movie about Edward Snowden would look like in a couple of years, because if you think about the American audience, what WikiLeaks basically did was released a lot of documents damaging to Americans' view, the view of Americans around the world, whereas what Snowden released were documents showing our government spying on Americans and other people. So it might be a different audience for that.
And if done well with his cooperation, it might be a good movie.
So we were talking about Edward Snowden and the NSA surveillance story. One of the reporters who was instrumental in bringing those to light, Glenn Greenwald, announced this past week that he was going to be leaving The Guardian to create a new media company that was going to be backed by eBay founder Pierre Audemars. Journalist Jeremy Scahill and documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras, who also worked with them on the NSA stories, is going to be joining that venture as well. Were you guys surprised when you heard about this?
You know, it's in line with some of these big tech leaders deciding that journalism is either important or sexy, or there's some money to be made or whatever. I mean, we know Jeff Bezos and buying the Washington Post recently. So here's another one of those tech billionaires who's looking to and says he wants to invest in journalism for the right reasons. In fact, he says that he wants to set up this Greenwald-based operation as sort of a general-purpose news operation that's digital only, but focuses on investigative reporting and the kinds of stories that were told through the leaks. That might be pretty interesting, but creating a sort of a general-purpose digital news site, it doesn't seem to me like a very easy job considering all the competition that's out there.
You're exactly right. It is the competition that's out there, because what you have right now is legacy media like the Washington Post and the New York Times that are moving into the same realm, and they have that name brand that's out there. So to build something from the ground up is going to be difficult, especially when you're having to go against established players in the game.
They have the name brand, plus they have significantly more manpower to put against it, too.
I mean, you read just a little bit. Jay Rosen, a journalism professor at NYU, had the only really in-depth interview so far with Omidyar about what he wants to do in Greenwald. And basically, they're saying that they're going to try to bring in all of these established writers and thinkers and put together a great team. Okay, that's fine if you invest in the right people. But it seems to me that the other thing he brings is an ability, kind of like Bezos, to understand exactly how to respond to what the audience wants in real time, based on recommendations, based on data, whatever. That could be helpful to them.
That could be helpful, and I think it will be helpful. The interesting thing would be, if it does take off and it does work, would one of the established brand news operations then try to, you know, purchase it?
I was going to say, do they then become?
You know, yeah.
Omidyar said that he actually was approached by the folks that own the Washington Post about buying them, and Bezos won out. So clearly, you know, he seems to be more interested in establishing his own beachhead in journalism and not picking up even a property as prestigious as the Washington Post. I wonder whether this new organization will be incorporated outside the United States.
That was the first thing that I thought about, too, because I think that would give them a little bit more flexibility, depending on where this operation is housed to do some of the investigative things. But is it going to be able to give them a brand within the United States to do the kind of investigative reporting that needs to be done here at a local, state, and national level? Or is it going to be more of an international flavor that may not necessarily connect with an American audience?
Have you seen the cover of the November Elle magazine yet? There are actually six of them that are going to be hitting newsstands. And one of them features actress Melissa McCarthy wearing a knee-length dress and a baggy overcoat. Critics say editors deliberately tried to hide the plus-size star of Bridesmaids, covering her full body, while the other stars, including Reese Witherspoon and Penelope Cruz, show off considerably more skin. McCarthy hasn't spoken about this personally, but according to other folks supposedly in the know, she's okay with the cover.
But on The View today, co-host Jenny McCarthy defended Melissa McCarthy, who happens to be her cousin.
The thing that drives me nuts is that people are up in arms saying, Elle, how dare you? McCarthy girls, no one's going to make us wear anything we don't want to wear.
Similarly, Elle is making no apologies, telling ABC News, Melissa loved this look and is gorgeous on our cover. When McCarthy appeared on this cover of Good Housekeeping, her body was obscured by a present. On the covers of More, The Hollywood Reporter, and Ladies Home Journal, her body is nowhere to be seen. As for this cover, McCarthy reportedly loves it.
So we saw a variety of covers there. There was a pattern. The L one was the first one that pretty much showed her full body. Is there a double standard going on here?
Yes. You're always going to have I wouldn't say always, but in today's magazine culture, yes, there is a double standard, and a lot of it is what's going to sell the magazine. Magazines traditionally have been sold on the racks and in grocery stores and in Targets and Walmarts and that sort of thing. And what you see on the front cover is what draws people in. And historically, magazines have gone down the line that we want to have this certain look on our front cover. And even though I think this look for Melissa McCarthy is going to bring in readers and viewers. But I think, you know, if they had gone without the coat, who knows?
I mean, I think Elle gets to have its cake and eat it, too. I mean, they get to have the magazine cover.
We're still talking about
yeah,
it.
No, right, exactly. Right, I mean, yeah. They get to have the magazine covers, you know, with Reese Witherspoon and Penelope Cruz. It'll draw on the people who are attracted to that type of Hollywood
celebrity. And those will be the ones that are on the rack.
But they get all of this attention on this story. They get to look like that they're, you know, that they're being enlightened by having a plus-size actress on the cover wrapped up in the trench coat. And Melissa McCarthy says all the right things about how I wanted it that way. I love this coat, blah, 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 blah. And so they've also kind of learned from a long line of magazine publishers over the past couple of years who have used these sort of faux controversies over covers to generate readership.
And I mean, she is a star. She is one of the most bankable women stars right now in television and in the movies. So as Mike said, they're going to get a win-win out of this because people are just going to see her and want to read what is she saying in this magazine article. So I think in a lot of ways they can show her in this light and still be able to say, well, you know, we've presented her in the way in which she wanted to be presented, not the way we wanted her to be.
And even the bloggers who hate this are linking to the cover, or you can very easily, in a couple of clicks, get from one of those hater blogs right to the magazine.
To the statement that's on the magazine's own website.
Right.
Okay, well, tonight is a big night for baseball fans. The Cards take on the Boston Red Sox in Game 1 of the World Series. But it seems the Cardinals aren't getting too much love from the national press. We've seen headlines this week that read 23 reasons why it's perfectly okay to despise the St. Louis Cardinals and why your Cardinals suck. Mike, you brought this to my attention. What's going on here? Why is there no love for our home state team?
Well, part of it is that people like underdogs, and the Cardinals are not underdogs. I mean, they have been in the... You know, they've won the National League Championship, what, four times in the last 10 years, and they've won the World Series a couple of times in that period of time. So they're winners. And people like the sort of gutty underdog story of the Pittsburgh Pirates or whatever. And so you have people who are upset about that. They want to root for the underdog. But you also have the fact that a lot of broadcasters, journalists, and other folks have talked about the Cardinals as this rare team that does it the Cardinal way. And it's true. I mean, a lot of their players come up through the farm system more than any other team. They have a payroll that was a third the size of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they still beat them. And so people don't like that. They don't like all the talk among journalists about how the Cardinals play the game. They're scrappy characters, or that the fans are the best fans in baseball, that they don't boo the opponents and that kind of stuff.
Well, but Cardinals fans, generally speaking, have been for decades. I mean, this even goes back to when my Uncle Herb founded Baseball Digest magazine in the mid-60s. The idea of Cardinals fans have been some of the most educated out there, some of the most knowledgeable about baseball.
And I think it's true, but I also think, and Ernest, I don't know if you would back me up on this or not, but part of it is just the fact that you have the media, sports media around World Series time, they need headlines. They need something to write about.
They
writing about the goody two-shoes Cardinals is not going to sell newspapers or TV shows.
Well, you know, haters got to hate. And there's a lot of hate on the coast for the Cardinals because they've been able to put together not just this team, but a franchise and an organization that does it without spending a whole lot of money and bringing in a whole bunch of superstars. I mean, they had a superstar in Albert Pujols. And instead of giving him the big contract that the Los Angeles Angels did or that the Florida Marlins wanted to do, they said, we're going to go ahead, we're going to let you go, we're going to take that money, and we're going to spread it out among the people that we have here now, and we're going to continue to build this franchise. And that is the way in which they do it. There are no boisterous stars on that team. Everyone plays together. They support each other. And they do it in a way that doesn't quite fit in with the way in which sports broadcasting goes now. You've got to have villains, and you've got to have these sort of heroes. And there are no villains or heroes on this team.
I also think that you do have a sense for some people that the broadcasters who do these games, there are a lot of homers there, you know? I mean, Bob Costas is a homer. Joe Buck is a homer.
McCarver is a homer.
Tim McCarver is a homer for the Cardinals, right? So you get a lot of that, and that's understandable. But I also just think that there are some people who react to the fact that no team or no fan base can be that perfect. And it's true, the Cardinals aren't perfect. I mean, I think it was atrocious what they did, especially what La Russa did to encourage Mark McGwire and basically cover for him and allow him to be the poster boy for the steroid
era. The simmering animosity between St. Louis and Cincinnati, which a lot of it was Dusty Baker and La Russa more so than it was the players themselves. So, I mean, you're right, they aren't perfect. But in an age where you have all of these sort of narratives of good and bad that go on, especially in sports, that element's not here. And I think what they're trying to do is sort of create that for the World Series so they can have some sort of backdrop for this. But it's a difficult thing to do because there are people who like St. Louis and there are people who like Boston.
I do think that Boston is probably going to, you know, win the narrative battle for the World Series. I mean, you heard some stories this morning on Morning Edition about how, you know, less than a year after the Marathon bombing, they're pulling themselves back up by their bootstraps. They got all these guys like Big Poppy and the Beards and all that. They're going to have a fine narrative that will compete very well with the goody two-shoes Cardinals.
Well, some fans here in Columbia and Jefferson City won't be able to watch the telecast on Fox tonight. That's because DirecTV stopped carrying the networks of Mid-Missouri almost 2 weeks ago in a dispute over carriage fees. That means no ABC, no MeTV, no MyZoo TV, and no Fox. No Fox means no World Series. Ernest, you mentioned to me you're a DirecTV subscriber. What's the plan for tonight?
I have no plan as of this moment, but I'm going to figure something out before game time. But, you know, I thought that this situation between DirecTV and the Press Gazette, which is the owner of the stations here in Columbia and Jefferson City, would have worked this out by now. But this thing is stretching into almost 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, and it doesn't seem to be an impasse. But even more so than the World Series, there are a lot of people who are addicted to scandal on ABC who've been having to watch it on online and that sort of thing, who are just furious by this. So I think they have more to worry about there than they do about the World Series right now.
Okay, well, the next story is a debate that's been going on for a long time, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it last week since we were off the air. It has to do with the Washington Redskins and how some people find that team name offensive and want it changed. One of those is NBC's Bob Costas. Here he is from a week ago Sunday, just before the Redskins-Cowboys game.
The NFL franchise that represents the nation's capital has maintained its name. But think for a moment about the term Redskins and how it truly differs from all the others. Ask yourself what the equivalent would be if directed toward African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, or members of any other ethnic group. When considered that way, Redskins can't possibly honor a heritage or a noble character trait, nor can it possibly be considered a neutral term. It's an insult, a slur, no matter how benign the present-day intent. It's fair to say that for a long time now, and certainly in 2013, no offense has been intended. But if you take a step back, isn't it clear to see how offense might legitimately be taken?
So not everyone agrees with that. Here's radio show host Glenn Beck.
Could I just say, you sanctimonious piece of crap.
Yeah.
Why is it that all white people think that they have to correct all of the ills of and protect everybody else? Because everybody else is so little childlike, needs to be taken care of. What do these arrogant people think?
So we've got two very different perspectives here.
Well, let's see. We could point out that, let's see, how many millions of American Indians died at the hands of white people? We don't even have to go there to say it's easier to defend yourself if you have numbers. But I think most people would agree who look at it dispassionately and are not worried about, you know, their favorite team or political correctness, that probably the name Redskins is different from some other mascot names that are derived from American Indians. So I think the only question is, does Bob Costas, is it his place to talk about this on a broadcast? And I think he's earned, you know, his stripes with his journalism and lots of things going back from baseball coverage to Olympics to his Jerry Sandusky interview, on and on and on. He's earned, if anybody has, the right to talk about that during a football broadcast.
And I think it's an issue. I think Bob Costas is a good person in sports journalism to be able to comment on this issue. But the issue itself is something that the NFL is going to have to address because it is out in the open now. You've had the president talk about it. You've had the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, talk about it. You've had other figures within the political, social, and cultural arena that are saying that something needs to be done. So I don't think it's a question of if, but of when. I think at some point, Daniel Snyder, who is the owner, who has said that he is steadfastly
adamant about he won't do it.
Well, you know, there have been a lot of people who've been adamant about a lot of things over the course of history and have had to change one way or another. So I think, like I said, it's a question of if, not when. It's something that name will change at some point.
One of the things I also found interesting is that NBC Sports has now produced a section of its website in which it basically backs up and lays out all of the things that Costas put out there and makes a case for and putting the pressure on to do that. Well, like always, we're out of time before we're out of things to talk about. Thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background for today's topics on our links blog under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there or send us an email. You can do that at views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. Special thanks to Sarah Harkins for joining us in studio as floor director today. We're going to be taking a quick break next week, making room for some special programming, but you're going to want to stay tuned to KBIA and KBIA.org for details on that. And in 2 weeks, we're going to have what promises to be a great show for you here on Views of the News. New York Times media reporter Brian Stelter will join Mike, Ernest, and me in studio for a special edition of Views of the News.